This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I have the great pleasure of talking to Christopher Ingram. He's the author of a book called If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home By Now. The subtitle is Why We Traded the Commuting Life for a Little House on the Prairie. Kind of a cute title, I think. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing great, and thank you so much for having me on today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I like this book a great deal. I have sort of Minnesota roots in my family, which kind of attracted me to the story when I read about the book. Mm-hmm. But of course, where you are in Minnesota is the far northwest, close to North Dakota.
Yes.
And I guess we should do a little introduction to the book itself. You are a reporter for the Washington Post. You were and still are. What this book is about is the story of how you got from the Baltimore, Washington, D.C. area to one of the smaller towns in Minnesota, where you live now.
Yes.
So maybe it's better for you to tell that story than for me to do that. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So I'm a data reporter at the Washington Post. So my beat is kind of very broad. It's anything involving numbers. I'm drawn to like really cool data sets. And in 2015, I stumbled across this interesting data set that I'd never heard of before. And it was called the Natural Amenities Index. And it was actually put together by the USDA of all places. So it's like a federal data set. It's like the real deal. It's legit. And what they had done is they had actually basically ranked all 3,000 plus counties in the United States on their natural beauty. So, and they tried to quantify this. This is this thing that's very difficult to quantify. And so they took factors like, mild winter temperatures and abundant sunshine and lots of hills and lots of water and lakeshore and all the things that we think of as physical characteristics that make a place a nice place to live. And they kind of mashed this stuff all up in a statistical blender and it spat out these rankings. And so, the most beautiful place in America, according to this, ended up being like Ventura County, California. So think of that nice Mediterranean climate and the hills and the coast there and everything. And the place that was dead last on this list was a little place I'd never heard of called Red Lake County, Minnesota, population 4,000. As you mentioned, it's up in the far northwest corner of the state. We're actually about like 2 hours north of Fargo, North Dakota, to give you a sense of just how far north it was. And of course, at this point, when I'm writing this story, I had never heard of this place, never even set foot in Minnesota, never spent much time in the Midwest at all, honestly. As is custom for these kind of stories, you call out the high points, Ventura County, California, and you call out the low points. And so I characterized Red Lake County as, quote, America's worst place to live, which, was a fair characterization, I think, given the parameters of this data set. And I kind of, wrote up the story on the data set and mapped it all out and everything and kind of published it. And we're like, okay, that's kind of the end of it. That'll be it. And then I was very much just surprised immediately after the publication to suddenly just be inundated with a barrage of hate mail. Now, I will say it was very polite hate mail, but it was hate mail from Minnesotans all over the state on social media and on email who are just flabbergasted and frankly offended that any corner of their beautiful state could possibly be ranked as at the bottom of some, federal beauty pageant. And this all kind of snowballed from there, from this just outpouring of reaction that I got after writing the initial story.
Well, and totally fair if you think about it. And I thought, I thought not only is it the idea that no one likes to feel that their beautiful place, and anybody I think would feel that way, is not beautiful, and that, there's this sort of reductionism of data that, mm-hmm. as you allude to later in the book, that it doesn't tell the full story of any place. And it was just like you're right, and kind of fairly a criticism of you as a writer, as a journalist sitting in Washington, D.C. in a newsroom. You're kind of writing this piece that they felt was kind of flippant and unfair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, well, the interesting thing is, like, so there are a whole bunch of places in America that ended up looking pretty bad on this index, right? A whole bunch of places in, like, North Dakota and Iowa and all these other places. The interesting thing, I didn't hear a peep from people in any of those places. As a matter of fact, I got an email from a guy in Omaha, Nebraska, which also ranked poorly on this list. And he was like, you know, I was going to send you an angry email and I was kind of upset about this, but then I thought about it and I realized Omaha really is kind of a dump, so I guess you were right in the end. So, you know, it was the fact that the outpouring of vitriol ended right at the Minnesota border that really kind of got my attention at this.
and to jump ahead a little bit, I don't want to tell the whole story of your book. I don't want to have to, you know, I don't want to do that to people who might want to read it. But you get invited out there by a local person, mm-hmm. a business guy who felt like, okay, this is what you want to say about us. Why don't you come see what it's really like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I went out and visited for kind of a follow-up story because it's like August in DC and there's not a lot of real news going on. So my editors were like, yeah, go out there, go, you know, do a follow-up, see what's actually like. And I'm from upstate New York, which is, you know, there's a lot of, you know, small towns and a lot of places where I'm from anyway. You know, my framework for understanding small towns and rural areas was kind of this Rust Belt idea of, you know, these small communities where people are really struggling, this kind of hillbilly algae framework that we're all familiar with now. But when I actually got out there, I was just kind of blown away. It was like a totally different mode of small town life. You get the sense that like any place else, you know, there are small farming communities out here and they have their challenges and they have their struggles, but there's a real sense that people are rising up and they're able to meet those struggles head on and overcome them. And they're still working proactively to make these communities better places to live. Just this incredible sense of social cohesion out there. And so that just kind of really opened my horizon to a totally different mode of rural and small town life that I hadn't really been familiar with before.
And so I guess we have to talk about the fact that, you know, and again, I think people need to read the book, but by a series of interesting events, you and your wife decided that you were, you know, you'd had enough struggling with the rat race of Washington, D.C., that, you know, which is a pretty tough place to live. I've lived there. Mm-hmm. I think the traffic is pretty hefty and the commute times are really long and real estate prices are ridiculous. And this is true in a lot of the, you know, the desirable cities of America, like Washington, especially San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, Boston, you know, all these cities where people really want to live because the urban areas are really attractive. That's mm-hmm. where jobs are. Mm-hmm. As you point out in the book, I think you said 84% of Americans live in urban or suburban America. Mm-hmm. And so it's a struggle because, you know, in part, it's the more people that go there, the more challenging it is. And so there's a kind of, I think what happened to you and your wife is that you had this unusual opportunity to see another place as possible. Mm-hmm. And you ended up amazingly moving to Red Lake County, Minnesota.
Yeah. And so this visit happened at like a kind of an interesting time in our life. We had just had twins. Our twins were two and we're living in this like cramped little row house in Baltimore County. And as you mentioned, the cost of living was just insane. I was commuting 3 hours a day. So 15 hours a week, 31 days a year on the train, in the car, trying to get to work. We were just being stretched a million different directions and like we couldn't make the numbers work. You know, if we were to move closer to DC, the prices would be out of reach. If we were to move farther away, the commutes would be 10 times longer. We just didn't know what to do. We were stuck. And finally, we were like, you know, and actually it was my mom of all people who kind of brought up the idea. She's like, well, why don't you guys, you know, move out to that nice little Midwestern town you visited over the summer and see how much you like that. And, you know, we kind of started thinking about it. And like, you know, there was the economic stuff and the cost of living, which was obviously a big factor. There was the attractiveness of raising our kids in a community like this. And then also just like as a data guy, it was kind of interesting to me as like a social experiment to like, okay, like let's kind of turn our lives upside down, you know, on the basis of a single data point and like, let's see what happens. Let's see how this plays out.
And it's sort of, well, I think a lot of people think about moving in that way. You know, it's kind of wherever you live, you're always wondering, is there a better place? You know, could it be? And I think this desire for simplicity and a more comfortable rural environment, which we, I think, sometimes idealize, as you indicate in the one of the data points I think you quoted, is that while 85% of the people live in this urban and suburban environments, I think it was 54%. Is that the right number?
Yeah, something over half of people, yeah.
Would prefer, their ideal place to live is in a small town.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, and we could talk about, you know, well, maybe that's partially based on a kind of mythological view of what small town life is, you know, like based on the movies or television shows or books we've read, this sort of, or the mythology that's passed down to us from, in families, because many American families come from rural places and then end up, the children end up moving and the grandchildren or whatever it is, by now three generations removed from the farm, let's say. You know, we're in the city, but the mythology within the family is that beautiful little house on a 40-acre farm with the flowers and the garden and a, you know, a cow, you know, things that's a lot, that is a kind of defining image of American, Jeffersonian America. So, so it makes sense. And I can share that. I can feel that in myself, you know, having at various times lived in small towns and wanting to have that comfort of knowing the people in the community. When you live in a bigger city, you know, it's much harder. So, but you had this kind of, I think what happened with you is somewhat unusual compared to most people. You were able to go, you were able to, your wife and you agreed, and she'd never been there before either. So,
yeah, no, she kind of agreed to this sight unseen, which is... And, you know, my wife, like, she really doesn't like the cold. And, like, one of the reasons this place ranks so poorly is because it's, like, literally one of the coldest places in America in the winter. This past winter, it got down below negative 40 for, like, several days. And so she was like, you know, she was a little skeptical. She was like, so how cold does it get there, actually? I'm like, oh, it's not that cold. Like, you know, it's not much worse than upstate New York or whatever. So I had to kind of fudge some of the data a bit to get her on board. But, you know, we were in kind of a unique situation because my job is very portable. I'm a data reporter. I'm not, like, attached to any, you know, specific location. 99% of my work is via phone or internet. So I can take my job with me. And I think there's actually a lot of, you know, white-collar office work that that kind of applies to. But, you know, it's just not, you know, telework, just it's still not as widespread as, you know, we might have expected, say, 10 years or so ago. But telework was really the key that made this whole thing possible for us.
Right. And also that your wife was willing to essentially change careers from being a worker with a management career at the Social Security Administration to becoming a full-time parent. Which is, you know, in my view, that's a job. So she changed. Yeah. She changed careers, and you know that must have been stressful. I think for her, and for you as well.
Yeah, the transition was much more jarring for her, I think, than it was for me, because I was still doing basically the exact same thing I'd been doing before, but she was switching radically from, like, you know, government work and management work in an office to dealing with two toddlers all day, which, you know, those two jobs, there are some overlapping skills, but, like, it's a very different day-to-day. And so that was challenging for her, but she's... You know, she's one of the nice things about living out here for her is that she's a very, like, social, she's a very people-oriented person. And in a small town, there are so many opportunities to volunteer and help out the community. So she is, you know, she's on the board now of, like, the Northwest Minnesota Arts Council. And then, you know, last year she actually ended up getting elected to the city council of the town of Red Lake Falls. So she's, you know, she's staying busy. And it's kind of funny to think that, like, on the basis of this, like, throwaway line that I wrote in a goofy story 4 years ago, she's now, like, actually making decisions to chart the future progress of this town in the middle of nowhere in Minnesota.
Well, it is, I found myself throughout reading this book, I was sharing pieces of it with my wife and people I knew, my friends and family, because I thought so much of it was really, it was funny. There's some funny parts, there's some fun, but it's also, I think, a very, it's a telling story. I think there's a lot here beyond your personal experience. You know, I mean, you use your personal experience to tell a bigger story, I think, mm-hmm. about misconceptions that people have developed. You know, we have a kind of current schema of how the world works. And I think that your book does a lot to perhaps change the narrative about how we think about small towns, how we think about what people's lives are like outside of the big cities, which tend to cast the narrative more than this, because they have a louder, and more people, they have a louder voice. They, the media that, you know, everybody talks, calls the media as if it was one whole, you know, one thing, and it isn't, but the various media forms that we consume, mostly come from urban sources.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I hope that if this book does anything for, you know, people on the coast, you know, aside from the people who are wanting to get out and looking for, you know, kind of a template and, you know, kind of some inspiration on how to do that. But I hope this kind of demystifies small town and rural areas a bit, because there's this real big narrative, this dominant narrative right now about this rural urban divide. And, you know, you get news organizations sending these reporters just kind of parachuting into these far off urban places and kind of treating it like they're going, you know, going on safari among the working class or whatever. And then they're coming back with these hard won pearls of like authentic rural knowledge from real America. And I just feel like after living here for so long, like, I feel like that kind of coverage does a real disservice to the people who actually live out here in these places. The people out here are just complicated, normal people, like people any place else. You know, they watch the same media, they're following the same news stories, they consume the same entertainment. And I just found, like, I was expecting there to be more of a divide. I expected more things to be standing between myself and the people who I now call neighbors. But I found that not to be the case at all, and found that, you know, that living here is like just like, you know, living in a suburb or living in a city, except there's fewer people.
So, but you do have some stories about your adaptational struggles to fit into the local culture. And so,
Yeah, sure.
Because, it, you know, obviously you came there open-minded, and I think there's a certain understory there, which is that you're the outside guy. You know, you're this guy from far away, and it's unusual for people to drop into Red Lake County, Minnesota, I assume, from someplace far away. So, and because you came with that connection, having been the guy who wrote this story, I think that you were, your experience might be different than, let's say, the average person who moves there without a public underpinning to their story.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're kind of treated to the experience in a special way, it feels like. And that's not to be critical. That just is a kind of contextual framework that you're it heightens your experience, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, one of the weird things about coming out here, like at first, it was about being recognized all the time. People would be like, hey, you're that Washington Post reporter. And I'd be like, yeah, you know, and that kind of weirded us out at first. But then we realized, you know, this is the kind of place where, like, literally everybody knows who everybody else is, and they say hi anyway. And so everybody, you know, recognizes everyone else. So we kind of, you know, came to make our peace with that. Sorry, I'm working my home office, and that's my kids being obnoxious in the background. But yeah, there's definitely something strange about that. So if you have time for a very brief story that did not make it into the book, but my favorite story about being recognized out here for who I am. And this actually happened on the day of the book release. I ended up having to take a surprise visit to the urologist's office for something that ended up being kidney stones. And it's like, totally fine. I'm fine now. No worries, no problems. But at the time, we didn't know this. And like, the closest urologist, because we're in a rural area, is like in North Dakota. So I have to drive an hour away to get there. And so, you know, urologist office, not very pleasant place to be. They have to do a lot of, like, very kind of invasive procedures. And so, like, the doctor's there, and we're talking about the symptoms and whatnot, and he's like, you know, we're getting ready to do, like, the hands-on part of the exam, like, the really uncomfortable part. And he's like, okay, so, you know, take your pants down. And, you know, he's like, he's kind of pulling on the rubber gloves and everything. And he starts just trying to make, you know, do some chit-chat to help me, like, you know, feel comfortable or whatever. And he's like, so, you know, where are you from and how did you end up out here? And blah, blah, blah. And where do you work? And I'm like, oh, I write for the Washington Post. And he's like, Washington Post, huh? And I'm like, yeah. And then like literally as my pants hit the floor, I see with horror the spark of recognition in his eye. And he's like, hey, you're that guy. And I'm like, yeah, I'm that guy standing there before him without my pants on. And we proceed to have this like 20-minute conversation about, oh, how do you like it and what have you and blah, 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 while I'm standing there with my pants off. So, you know, the circumstances surrounding our arrival did lead to some kind of weird situations like that. But, you know, overall, it's been mostly positive.
Well, and of course, you do talk about some of the issues that are faced by people who live in rural areas where the nearest hospital is, I think, well, did you go to Crookston, was it?
Yeah, the nearest hospital is Crookston. So it's, you know, like it's half an hour away. So, you know, trips to the ER when the kids do something, you know, dumb to themselves and hurt themselves, it can be a long trip. And so, you know, there are certain challenges of rural life that we've kind of had to adapt to.
And then I assume, you know, food shopping, as I think you mentioned at one point, although I thought of this as a kind of advantage when you live in a small town and you consume some kind of special food that's not normally stocked by your local grocery store, they actually will order it for you because you are so important and known as a customer. You know, you'll buy it. So, I mean, that's something that people don't get to experience who live in big cities, you know, that your local grocery store will carry something just for you.
Yeah. So we got out here and like people out here hadn't heard of Prosecco, and like that's all my wife likes to drink, really. So we kind of like told the local liquor store guy, like, hey, there's this stuff called Prosecco, and like if you could stock it for us, like we'd, you know, be in here buying it. And so, you know, he's like, yeah, sure. So we, you know, he stocks Prosecco and we buy it. And so, you know, it's, you can kind of you know, bridge some of those cultural gaps that way fairly easily, because, you know, people know who you are and they're happy to make exceptions for you because, you know, your friends and neighbors, basically.
So, you know, and aside from some of the things that you talked about in the book, what would you say today is the biggest, I don't want to say impediment, but, you know, if you had to sort of measure your daily life in Red Lake County, which doesn't have a lake, as you point out, and Red Lake Falls doesn't have a falls. I love that. Those are two of my favorite parts of the book.
Yeah, it's so Midwestern, right? Like, it's got these names that have nothing to do with the reality of the place.
But of all of the things, the good and the bad, like what would be the thing that is most difficult for you and maybe your family, you know, not just you personally, but what do you think is the hardest part of being in a small town so far away and, of course, in this extreme weather, extreme climate, I should say, you know, that all of those factors together, what thing is really the most difficult to live with when you're there?
Yeah, you know, there are a couple of things. There are work-wise, there are some challenges to being out here, and there are benefits too. Like I get keyed into stories that I would not, you know, hear about or know about otherwise. But you know, it can be challenging to feel, you know, sometimes so disconnected from like the newsroom and like the goings on in DC. And then I'll say, you know, physical space and climate-wise, like the winters here, we found that it's not so much like how cold it gets, but it's rather how long winter lasts that can be a challenge. I mean, last year it started snowing at the end of September, and it didn't stop until May. So when you're dealing with that much cold, and like, so, you know, you get the days where it's like January, and you've had like 4 months of winter already, and like the kids are going crazy, and you're like, man, what are we going to do today? And we still have four more months of this. But so we've been, you know, learning adaptation strategies, and, you know, people do their best to kind of stay busy and keep about their lives. And we're trying to embrace all the outdoor winter recreation opportunities up here. And, you know, the flip side of that is that, you know, those winters and that brutal climate, it really makes possible some things you can't do anywhere else. Last winter, we did a brief sled dog tour in one of the neighboring towns. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, like, it was really cool. It was an incredibly cool experience. And if any of your listeners get a chance to do it anywhere, I would recommend doing it. But I was thinking, man, you know, I was talking to the guy at the Musher who used to race and who had done this his whole life. And he's like, there are fewer and fewer places in America where we can do this now. It just doesn't get cold enough anymore. And so, you know, the sport and the culture around this is dying out. And so it made me realize that, you know, in a place where that kind of thing is still possible, that's something that's really special. And that's, you know, that's a function of that category in the spreadsheet that gets treated as a negative in that USDA ranking. But just on the basis of that data set, you don't see the flip side of that piece of data and the, you know, the positive things that can provide.
Well, that's true. I guess the other thing similar to that is ice fishing, which I think is not something that is commonly, you know, possible in places other than northern Minnesota, maybe northern Wisconsin and Michigan, where the winters are really long, it gets really cold. So you get enough ice that people can put a little house out on a lake and then auger a hole in the ice so they can fish.
Yeah, the ice fishing culture out here is very serious. Like, people have these things, they call them ice castles, like, that they haul out onto the lake. And they're like, you know, there are resorts on some of the larger lakes. And they have these fleets of just the most outlandish vehicles you have ever seen. These, like, treaded vehicles cobbled together from old car parts. It looks like something out of Mad Max that they use to kind of drive around on the ice and, like, you know, ferry customers and people sleep out on the ice. Like, you can rent a house and, like, just kind of stay out on the ice on the lake all winter if you want to. So there's this really kind of strange and unique culture that gets attached to ice fishing up here.
Right. And then there's also, I think, ice racing, because you can put these special tires on, which have the metal pieces that allow you to get traction on ice. You can race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all kinds of stuff. Hockey is another big one up here. A lot of the parents are just super into hockey. But, you know, as soon as we got here, the first thing other parents in town were asking us, they're like, so when are you going to put skates on those kids? But we're trying not to do too much of the heavy contact sports. So we'll see how long we're able to hold out with them for. But yeah, we'll see how that goes.
And how about your kids? Are they pretty happy there?
They are loving it. And, you know, that was one of the real draws, was, you know, being able to raise them in this kind of environment, that kind of, you know, we idealized the small town environment, but we found, especially with respect to the kids, that, like, a lot of that is very true. And just the, you know, we live in a nice little neighborhood town here, and there are a bunch of other kids their age, and, like, you can just kind of send them outside at the beginning of the day, and they'll run around with their friends across the neighborhood, and, like, you know that other people are watching out for them, and that other kids are going to take care of them. And, you know, the schools, one of the things about Minnesota in general, and it's true up here as well, is that people take education very seriously, and there's a lot of funding available for schools, and the school is kind of like a central pillar of the community. So it's very important to people up here to have good education. And, you know, one of the surprisingly nice things about being up here is that in a town this small, there is just one school. So, like, it's not like in Baltimore, D.C., where, like, you are constantly trying to game out, like, okay, like, I need to get my kid into the right preschool so he can go to the right elementary school, so he can go to the right high school. Like, you don't have to do any of that here. There's one school. Everyone goes there. You don't have to make those kind of choices at all, which is kind of liberating in some ways.
And do you mean one school in elementary, you know, that grade school, or is that includes the high school as well? So it's all.
Yeah, no. So there's one grade school, and then the kids go over to the high school after there. So it's not like right. It's not like a one room schoolhouse kind of thing. Although there are plenty of people out here who, like, grew up and did go to one room schoolhouses, but they have the elementary school, and then they go to the other side of the town where the high school is.
Right. So the town's big enough to have its own high school at least.
Mm-hmm.
Which is good, because, yeah, you know, traveling, some of those schools, you know, the rural districts don't have their own high schools. Then those kids are spending a lot of time in the bus
Yeah, and that's certainly the case out here. You know, even with the school district that our kids are in, you know, we're right in town, so it's not an issue. But some of the kids who are farther out, they spend, you know, an hour on the bus every morning and every afternoon. So that's, you know, that can be a real issue for these rural places for sure.
Right. Well, and what do you think? I mean, I guess you have the, you know, this advantage of being able to work there and have a job essentially that from somewhere else. But is it, I mean, I think a lot of people wonder, like, what job could I get if I move to a small town? What do you think about that?
Yeah, that is definitely the problem, you know, that holds a lot of people back from, you know, from moving to a place like this, is that largely there, you know, there aren't a whole lot of jobs out here. Out here, it's a little unique because in the next town over from us, a town called Thief River Falls, there's a big facility that makes Articat snowmobiles, and then there's also a very large digital equipment manufacturing facility that does all sorts of international business and whatnot. And, you know, there are schools out here. There's a community college in one of the towns next to us, and then there's a regular four-year University of Minnesota school 20 minutes away. So, you know, for the right kind of people, there can be jobs out here, but like that's absolutely the challenge. And it's not just the job for like one spouse, but if you're like a family thinking of coming out here and like, you know, one parent gets recruited, well, what's the other parent going to do? And so that's something that a lot of these towns are struggling with. They're like, okay, you know, we figure out how to do the specialized recruitment to get the right people for the kind of jobs we have, but we're struggling with what to do with the spouse and, like, you know, how to deal with that. So that's certainly a challenge.
Yeah. Do you think that the state of Minnesota, because it's large, mm-hmm. Geographically, also diverse because it has so many smaller communities, as well as Minneapolis, St. Paul, obviously very large city, mm-hmm. But also some other fairly large cities like Rochester and Duluth. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like being out there, you have a sense, because if you look at New York State's also highly rural, mm-hmm. highly, you know, lots of small cities, lots of smaller towns, mm-hmm. and then a couple of really big cities. So the demographic profile of New York State, where you're from, in a certain way is not that different from the demographic profile of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. But it does feel like palpably there's a difference between the outlook of those two states, the way they think of each, you know, think of themselves. And maybe that's, you know, partly a Midwestern thing. It's partly, you know, the communities, the types of people that moved there historically. But what's your, I mean, do you have a feel for how Minnesota copes with, you know, maybe socially and politically, the needs of its smaller towns like you live in now?
Yeah, and I will say that definitely similar to New York State, you do get some of that tension between, you know, the rural parts of Minnesota and then, you know, the Minneapolis region, which just, you know, population-wise just completely outweighs the rest of the state. And you see something similar going on in upstate New York, where a lot of upstate New Yorkers can be, you know, resentful of, you know, the money or the attention or whatever it is that the city is getting. I'll say it is different out here. Minnesota, I think, does a better job redistributing money to its smaller areas. Minnesotans actually voted at the ballot to raise taxes on themselves a few years ago in order to fund both community arts projects and outdoor recreation projects. So there's like this special tax that gets funding for arts and for outdoor hunting and fishing and that kind of thing. And that money gets dispersed to the small communities and their advisory boards within the communities that handle these funds. So Minnesotans actually, you know, they voted to kind of, you know, redistribute some of that wealth and attention. And I think that makes a difference. People really kind of appreciate that. And people are aware of that tax and that they're paying it and where that money is going to. And then the other thing I'll say is that because in these small communities, in this part of the state at least, where it's just all farming, and there are, you know, there are fewer farms now than there used to be, but the total acreage is the same because farms are getting, you know, they've just been getting consolidated over the past few decades. So the farms are still there, the acreage is still there, and that money is still coming in there in a way that maybe it is not in upstate New York, where you have, you know, you don't have that kind of farming situation.
Well, at least it seems to me what you've just described is something that's really important. And I know we don't have much more time, but I think what you've highlighted is that there is that through taxation, through that awareness of the value of community, that Minnesotans have increased the bonds between the urban and rural populations, that in a way that I think is unusual in America, because partly because, you know, we've sort of taught ourselves to think taxes are bad. But, you know, in some ways, what you've just described is really the meaning of community, that we live, you know, we do live together, we do share values. And I think what your book promotes is the idea that we are more alike than we are different, and that that should be something we pay attention to.
Yeah, and there's, you know, there's this kind of, there's this very kind of pro-social way of thinking out here. And you look at traditional measures of social capital, capital like voting participation or census participation. Minnesota, and all over the state, Minnesota is just at the top of the list. And there is that real concern for, you know, for communities and for making their communities better and for thinking of those things in social terms rather than strictly in individualistic terms. And I think that's one of the things that makes this place really special, and it's one of the things that so far has made it just a great place to be raising our kids.
Well, you've done a good job of reminding me of why I like Minnesota so much, and why I have also talked about it as a different kind of place than most Americans are used to seeing. Christopher, I really want to thank you for being on this program with me. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Christopher Ingram about If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home by Now, Why We Traded the Commuting Life for a Little House on the Prairie. A terrific book. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks so much for having me.